The reading this morning is taken from Romans 8, 35, and then 37 through 39. It's found on 983 in your pew Bible. Who then can ever keep Christ's love from us? When we have trouble or calamity, when we're hunted down or destroyed, is it because he doesn't love us anymore? And if we are hungry and penniless or in danger or threatened with death, has God deserted us? Despite all this, overwhelming victory is ours through Christ, who loved us enough to die for us. For I am convinced that nothing can ever separate us from his love. Death can't, and life can't. The angels won't, and all the powers of hell itself cannot keep God's love away. Our fears for today, our worries about tomorrow, or where we are, high above the sky or in the deepest ocean, nothing will ever be able to separate us from the love of God, demonstrated by our Lord Jesus Christ when he died for us.
The Wesley United Women are pleased to have the Reverend John Martin speak to us today. Reverend Martin has served several churches and a couple of them here in Northern Virginia. He is now superintendent of the Petersburg District. He has made 75 mission trips to 20 countries. 30 of these trips have been to Haiti. We are honored to have you with us today, Reverend Martin. Thank you.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. And happy Father's Day, all you dads. This is Father's Day, right? I'm still waiting to hear from my own children, but I'm going to give them a little bit more time. Well, it's certainly nice to be at Wesley Church. I don't think I've ever been here before. I've driven up and down Route 1 hundreds of times, but just never turned off on Mohawk before. And, you know, I remember when I was ordained, Bishop Cannon asked me in a very special way, Mr. Martin, will you be punctual? And I've been trying to live up to that ever since, but I'm still struggling with it, as you can see. We thought the service was at 11, and I'm just so glad I called one of your members just to double check the time at 10 o'clock. Well, I had my first heart attack about a half an hour ago, but I'm getting over it. It's great to be with you, and really, I probably should not be in this pulpit this day. Your own pastor probably should be here because this is a pivotal Sunday, isn't it? And I know the emotions run deep of grief in some ways and joy in other ways as you remember the good things that have happened and excitement about new things to come. But there's a grief in being a United Methodist for clergy and for congregations at these times of transition. And only by the grace of God, we somehow get through it, and we move on, and we find that God is waiting for us in the new place. I remember I once had a very flashy associate pastor. We were serving in Williamsburg, and he dressed to the nines, and he wore outrageous colors, and especially outrageously colored socks. I mean, if I dressed like him, they would have taken me on over to Eastern State, but he could get away with it. There was just something about his personality. He could get away with that outlandish behavior. Well, his successor was nothing like him. Totally different personality, kind of quiet, great big guy. And I wondered how we were going to make this transition. And the successor walked out into the middle of the room. He had on a black robe. And he just pulled his robe up, and you could see that he was wearing black socks. And everybody just laughed and applauded. They knew that there had been a sea change. We had something new had come to town, and we would adjust to it, and we would be fine. So you'll do that as well, because you're United Methodists, and that's what we do. We're an itinerant church. We're always moving on to the next chapter. I thank you for opportunity to talk a bit about mission today. It's one of the passions in our lives, has been for a very long time. So I'm going to try to focus some of my thoughts around some of our experience and mission. But you always have to hold that in some tension with where the church is today and the things that are happening around us in the world. This is a crazy time that we're living in, isn't it? Global warming and the Gulf full of oil. And in my hometown of Fort Lupton, Colorado, I understand that you can light the water tap and it'll burn because there's methane gas coming out in my hometown. I said, that is really strange. That's made the national news. It's the only time my little town's ever made the national news for anything. Methane coming out of the water tap. So it's a strange world that we're in. We see cataclysmic events, whether by our own making or by so-called acts of nature. I don't call them acts of God. I think nature does what nature does. And God is there to help us as human beings to figure out what to do with it. First time that Mary Ann and I traveled to Haiti was back in 1978. We went with Doug and Doris True, who were wonderful lay people here in Northern Virginia. And we just kind of went on a lark. We thought, well, we've never been to Haiti. I remember my grandfather talking about going on a cruise ship, and they docked in Port-au-Prince. And he talked about how they would throw coins overboard, and some of the native Haitians would dive into the water down into the bay, and they would come up with those coins in their teeth. And I thought, oh boy, that'll be interesting. We'll go see that. Well, by the time we got to Haiti in 1978, there weren't any more cruise ships coming in there, and the harbor was so polluted that if anybody dived in, they would probably never come up. So we sure didn't see what my grandfather saw. But we went, and we worked in a very hot place out on the plain of La Tremblay, building a church, or not a church, but a school. And there was a little church right on this side of the road, and then we were building on the other side of the road. And I remember how hot it was. There were no trees, and it was just miserable. Nobody told us, don't go to Haiti in August. Go in January when sensible people go. We went in August and just about melted into a little blob on the ground. But we worked, and we tried to absorb what was going on around us, and it was a very powerful experience. We finally came to the end of it, got back on the airplane to fly home, and I looked out the window, and it looked kind of like a moonscape as we were taking off, because a lot of the trees had been cut down, hardly any trees left standing around the capital city, and they've all been cut down for charcoal, and we noticed these great washes, these ravines where all the topsoil had washed away and into the sea, and it looked like such a forbidding landscape, even though it was a very mountainous country. And I thought to myself, well, it's been interesting, but I'm never going back to Haiti again. This is it. We've done our little thing. Well, it just kept bothering me. And somebody had warned us, you go through these culture shocks. You go through one going into a place like that, but you go into an even greater culture shock when you come back home again. And I just couldn't quite equate my life, getting back into my air-conditioned car, going and sitting at a table full of food, dressing as I wanted to dress. I couldn't put my world in the right kind of juxtaposition with the world I just spent 2 weeks in. And it bothered me, and we talked about it, and we struggled with it. In about 6 months, we were making plans for our next trip to Haiti. We knew that we couldn't leave it alone because it wouldn't leave us alone. Haiti, as many of you know, is one of the poorest countries in the world. It's clearly the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. And we've seen poverty in lots of places, but Haiti is a special kind of place. You know, Christopher Columbus discovered this country, and when he found it, he thought it was the Garden of Eden. It was absolutely beautiful, trees and lush vegetation, and it was that way for a long, long time. Later on, slavery got in there, and eventually European nations began to exploit the resources of the country, and eventually the country just came undone. They did have a revolt, a successful slave revolt. In fact, it was the first country in the Caribbean to win its independence. They were very proud of it, except for one thing, the world did not support them in their independence. This country did not support them in their independence. And so they were just left struggling and struggling and struggling. And it's been that way to this very day. They've lived under dictatorships and tyranny and the awful influence of voodoo, which has controlled their lives in many ways through superstition. And even though they were once a great exporting country, exporting sugar and coffee and various fruits, today they have to import just about everything. And it's expensive to be there. But there's a Methodist church in Haiti. It's not the same as the United Methodist Church exactly, although we're close cousins. The Methodist Church reached Haiti through the MCCA, which is called the Methodist Church in the Caribbean and the Americas, and is based sort of on British Methodism. A lot of their pastors will study in Kingston, Jamaica, for their seminary. And so it's kind of British in certain ways. But the worship is lively. The music is just incredible, almost as good as your choir. The children love to be in church. There are always hundreds of children in church. And teenagers, believe it or not, teenagers are in church every Sunday. And so it's always a grand experience to worship in Haiti. But over the years, we've gotten involved in trying to find ways that would help the mission there through building churches, through schools, clinics, feeding programs, working with orphans. And it's been an interesting time. I used to think that this is just too overwhelming. It's just too big a problem. In fact, I've heard leaders of our own denomination call Haiti a basket case. It's just a basket case. Nothing really can be done. And so you take that kind of a picture and you add hurricanes that come almost every year. A few years ago, there were 4 in a row that just devastated the country. I said, how much worse can it get? Well, don't ever ask that question, because it can always get worse. And on the 12th of January of this year, a devastating earthquake. Nobody knew that Haiti was earthquake prone. I'd never heard of an earthquake down there. They might have had some little tremors, but a major earthquake. And it hit the capital city of Port-au-Prince with such force that by the time the numbers were added up, it was a huge, devastating toll. If any of you seen that picture of the Super Bowl, there's a blimp shot of the Super Bowl looking down on the stadium. They say that there are 75,000 people in the stadium on Super Bowl Sunday. It's a huge gaggle of people, sports fans, 75,000. When the earthquake hit Port-au-Prince, 3 times that many people lost their lives. It's a staggering toll. And today, those who are alive, some say that Haiti is a land of amputees, children and adults, children without parents, and adults with no sure way into the future. Now, the world has responded. There's no question about that. Money has come. In fact, our Virginia Annual Conference has raised over $1.5 million for UMCOR, which is fabulous. It's great. But the problem with aid is getting it where it needs to go. We were down there just in April, and we're working on a project, and couldn't see many signs of help. People still didn't have jobs. The whole city of Port-au-Prince, of 2 million people, had just collapsed. The whole city had just collapsed. Buildings had pancaked on top of, you know, floors on top of floors. And people were digging around in the rubble. There was dust everywhere, and it smelled bad. And it was hard to get around in the streets. And I thought, you know, where is the money? Where are the bulldozers? Where are the dump trucks? Where are the rock grinders, you know? Well, it's going to get there, I guess, eventually. But right now, it's hot. It's the rainy season. And almost everybody is living in a tent. You ever been in a plastic tent in 100-degree weather? Can you imagine living in a tent in this kind of heat and not much in the way of running water services, that sort of thing, available? Well, that's what it's like. In fact, you know, I was driving down Route 1 this morning. You know, there's some parts of Route 1 where there's a little bit of a median, you know, not a lot, but there's a little bit of median. Well, there's some roads in the city of Port-au-Prince like that. There is such a need for places to pitch your tent that many people, hundreds, have pitched their tent right in the median. While cars are flying this way and flying that way, they've set up housekeeping right in the middle of the road. It's an unimaginable situation. Well, there's an expression in Haiti. It says, many small make a great. And we'd learned that expression years ago and began to realize, you know, Lord, I can't do much, but I can do something. And I won't let what I can't do keep me from doing what I can do. Begin to realize that through the church, which is a wonderful delivery mechanism, you can do small things. We had started to build that church, that school. I keep calling it a church. It's a school in La Tremblay. And we got the first floor up. We had a guy from OSHA on our team who was real upset about the well. Said the well was not a safe well. It didn't have a proper cap on it. And he kept going on about this. I said, well, why don't you just go put a cap on that well? He said, okay. And so he did. And he put an OSHA cap on that well and put his initials on it and wrote OSHA on it. OSHA approved well out in the sticks of Haiti. He was so proud of that. Well, about 20 years later, we were riding down a road outside of Port-au-Prince, and I saw this sign that said, La Tremblay. I said, stop the bus. Let's go back. It could be the same place. So we backed up, we drove into this courtyard, and here are two big two-story school buildings. Beautiful school. I said, can't be the same place. We're looking around, and I said, well, it might be the same place. And after a while, of course, the Haitians noticed there were strangers in the courtyard, and they came to get us, and they took me to the headmaster. And immediately the headmaster looked at me and said, I remember you. I said, what are you talking about? I remember you. You couldn't remember me. I was here 20-some years ago. I said, you can't remember me. You're just being nice. He said, no, really, I do remember you. You see, my father was the pastor of that little Methodist church right across the road from the school. And I was a little boy, 6 years old, when you were there running a medical clinic and building the first phase of this school. And today I'm the headmaster. I thought, wow, isn't that amazing? What are the odds of actually seeing an effort that you made 20 years back become something like that? I begin to realize that small things do add up. Many small make a great. It's been like that. But then, well, that's not the thing that draws us to Haiti. You know why we go to Haiti and to other places, but mostly Haiti now? Is because that's where we go to get our spiritual batteries recharged. I could tell you so many stories of transformation in that country. I think it has to do with the fact that Haitians know they don't have anything much. They've got very little going for them except one thing, their absolute confidence in God. You know, in the Bible, we read about the land of milk and honey. You ever read about the land of milk and honey? Do you know what that means, that expression? The milk is a reference to goat herding and sheep. You know, the nomadic life, you know, where they move from one waterhole to another looking for the next stand of grass. But the honey part, that has to do with fruit trees and a more settled existence, the farmer's life. So the settled life versus the nomadic life. And if you read the Bible closely, you always feel like God favors the nomadic side of it. Because they live so close to God. They don't know what the next day is going to bring, but all they have is that total dependence upon God. And God never disappoints. Haitians are a little bit that way. They never know what the next day is going to bring. What are you going to do when there's 85% unemployment in your country? What are you going to do for the next meal? What are you going to do when the next hurricane comes? They know a lot about prayer. They know a lot about helping one another. They know what it means to be a village. You know, it says it takes a village. We have seen that again and again. And the transforming effect on Americans who will go and be in that environment for a little while. I always say to people on these mission teams, don't go unless you're willing to have your life change forever. Because you get a new set of eyes, a new way of seeing the world. Right after Hurricane Katrina, we were in New Orleans working in that area and happened to step into the cathedral there, St. Louis Cathedral. You know that famous cathedral downtown New Orleans? I bet a lot of you have been down that way. And the priest had just read these words as I walked in the door. And this is what it said. Remember what happened to Job, don't you? He lost it all, even his family. And after all this bad news came to him, Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell on the ground and worshiped. And then he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Then the next verse, In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrongdoing. How many times have you heard people kind of blame God when things go wrong? Well, you know, I went to church and I did all this and what does God have against me? Maybe God's not even real. But these folks have lost it all. They've lost their children. And yet, while we were watching those pictures on television, you all saw them too. Conga line of people dancing down the street in Port-au-Prince, praising God in the midst of their loss. I said, how is that possible? And then I remembered one of the district superintendents from Haiti who had come to Atlanta last year for a Haiti consultation. And I remember him saying this, Haitian people know how to suffer. But as we suffer, we will be singing and dancing and praising the Lord. Think about that. I remember one woman they pulled out of the rubble. And as she came out, she was shouting, Jesus, Jesus, glory, hallelujah. She'd been in the rubble for days. You didn't see her. Well, God, you sure gave me a nasty blow here. Just praising God. I know your pastor and others of us were at annual conference this year. We heard Jim Gulley talking about being in the Hotel Montana with Clinton Rabb and Sam Dixon, who both died in the tragedy. Sam was the head of UMCOR. Clinton Rabb was head of Mission Volunteers for the Board of Global Ministries. They were all trapped in the hotel, and they believed they were going to be rescued. Jim was hurt. But he wasn't hurt the way the others were because they were pinned under floors and floors of the hotel. Their legs were crushed and could not move, and they were in awful pain. But Jim described in detail what they did in that time, how they sang hymns, they sang the doxology, they prayed with each other, and they felt themselves very close to God. This text that we read today from Romans saying that even in the midst of hardship and persecution, even in the midst of earthquake, a hurricane, or economic downturn, nothing can really separate us from the love of God, can it? Really? And we know that when we're at our least, when we're at our lowest ebb. One of our great theologians used to call that grace at 0 point. When we've used all our human ideas, all our human resources, and we realize we've played our best hand and we still haven't gotten ourselves out of the mess. And then all of a sudden, we sense that there's another resource that we need to finally rely on in a very radical way. It's the presence of God. know, the Haitians love Proverbs. They say things like this: well, Lord, your word is like alcohol. If it doesn't burn, it doesn't do any good. Or there's a great big devil out there. There's a big devil out there called discouragement, and he's bothering us. Please take him away. Well, my favorite is I can picture a woman standing on a mountainous hillside in Haiti, talking to God, just like you sometimes do, you know, just talking to God while you're ironing or whatever it is you're doing, driving to work, and sort of reflecting backwards on everything. And she said, Lord, they say we're the poorest country in the world. Thank you, Lord. Now make us poor in spirit that we might inherit the kingdom of heaven. I go to Haiti to find out what it means to be poor in spirit. That's why we go on mission. It's for us. It's for them too, but it's more for us, I really think. Because I get farther and farther away from God. I have a way of drifting, of kind of nibbling myself away from the source of my being. And I know that the only thing that's got to get me back is to get in a place where God can speak to me, get my attention. Well, I could go on, but I won't, because I know you got a few other things to do in this service. But I want to encourage you to be a church in mission. A famous Japanese theologian said that the church is to mission what a fire is to burning. I heard Denise Honeycutt recently say, she was quoting Mother Teresa, and she was talking about the people we serve. And she says, you know, if you can't see Jesus in the next person that you meet, you need not look any further. We're invited to have eyes to see and ears to hear, and then to gather up those resources God has given to us and put them to work that the kingdom of heaven might come on earth. Thanks be to God. Amen.